Well, I think it, we get started. I'm Quentin Lockwood. I'm the director of the Rural Urban Missions Department, the Home Mission Board. That's part of the Associational Missions Division. And I work with basically with associations and give a good deal of attention to small churches. That's what Bob Wiley and I do. That's what our conference is being built around, is the small church and things related to it. One of the things that I am to do this afternoon is to talk with you what I call, for lack of a better title, the call of the small. I'd like to begin by, first of all, talking with you about the call. Now, one of the things that we as Baptists believe and I'm sure that each of us feels deeply about is that the matter of a divine call. The call to be a minister, regardless of what form that ministry may take. But we do feel that it is something that, in a sense, is not of us. It comes from outside of us. And in my own case, it was something I felt I could not evade, but something that I must do. In a sense, it becomes a divine compulsion. But when that call comes, as it did to each of us, it didn't come with many strings or qualifications on it, did it? It didn't come saying, you know, you're called to be pastor of a church of 1,000 members or minister of education of a church of 700. It simply was a call to ministry, a call to service. We're the ones that have put quantitative kinds of figures. We're the persons who, in a sense, have taken a very divine kind of a thing and put upon it a very secular mold or model. And I don't know the answer to it, but we have pretty well applied the standards of success as applied in or found in the secular society to what is truly a spiritual society and ministry. We carry it over. We follow the model of the world's in the sense in which success is measured by size, buildings, dollars, staff, these kind of things. And you know, we find a good number of contrasts in that when you kind of just a casual looking at Scripture. You know, when Paul said that one of the marks of a child of God is that you seek the others rather than your own, a non-competitive approach. And then Jesus had something to say about it when he said, you know, if you want to be great, what do you have to do? You have to be small, don't you? You have to serve. If you want to be the greatest in the kingdom, you become the servant of all. You don't really take too much of that. It's not an area that we're real comfortable in. And so one of the things that comes out of this, I am going someplace with it, believe me, is that this sense of a loss of meaning of what call is sometimes puts us into a race or into a system that maybe isn't altogether scriptural and may not even be the best. Because we are the ones, it is the peers, we are the ones that say that, you know, if you don't move up, you're not successful. We're the ones that say, if you move, did he get a better church? That's, you know. And we always translate it out, you know, it's one of those things that churches wonder about when they're losing their pastor to a larger church. Do you ever know of a Baptist preacher that ever took a smaller church? Unless he had to, you know. He did that just one jump ahead of being fired. And that people puzzle on that. Why is it ministers have a tendency always to go to the larger? Now, we phrase it in very fine and pious tones. We put it in God talk. You know, I feel very committed to that. That's where God's leading me. Or we say, I feel like the Lord has prepared me for better and bigger things. I have to use my talents and exercise the abilities I have. This kind of a thing that we're involved in. So I would like for us to keep in mind that the call of God comes regardless of where the place of service is or the size of service and this kind of thing, that it is something that should not be measured necessarily against a background that comes out of the secular world. Now, let's look at a talk about small. Let's look at who Southern Baptists are and some things. How many of you went to church last Sunday? How many of you had more than 80 people present in the service where you attended? Well, you are aware then, you may not know it, that you who attended a church that had more than 80 people in attendance attended what is a very distinct minority of Southern Baptist churches. Out of 36,000 Southern Baptist churches, almost 61% of them have less than 300 members. Now, there's no such thing as a average Baptist church. And it's, you know, that's sort of like the average Baptist church is like this, an old joke, because it talks about the train when they had the Pullman car and they had Porter on the Pullman, and the fellow had never ridden the Pullman before. And so he wanted to do the right thing, and so he said to the porter on the train, I want to do what's right. What's the average tip? And the porter said to him, sir, it's $1. And so when he got off the train, he gave the porter $1. And the dollar said, thank you, sir. You're the first one that's ever come up to the average. So when you try to get into averages, but if you were to take a church, and normally in Southern Baptist life, we make the break. We say anything under 300 members is a small church, but I want to deal with that a little later. But if it is in Southern Baptist life, the way it breaks out according to Sunday school enrollment and other things, there's 54% of them are enrolled in Sunday school enrollment. And of the 54% you have slightly about 51% will be in attendance. That's 51% of this number. So if you start with 300, you know, this factors out to about 162. And then you see this would be about 81 or 82. If you were at that maximum 300. So, in Southern Baptist life, 61% of all of our churches have less than 300 members. And when we look at that, we find that this is where about one-fourth of Southern Baptist membership is to be found, is in these small churches. When we look at what is known as a rural urban scene, and some of you raise the question, what is rural urban? The easiest way to break it is anything under 50,000 populated, 49,999 and less, is usually counted as rural urban. That's where 10.4 million of our 13 million Southern Baptists are to be found, are in cities and towns under 50,000. We are basically a denomination of small churches in the smaller towns and areas. So 70-some percent of all of our people live in these kind of areas. But see, some of our largest churches are in towns of 25,000 to 40,000. But that's another thing. So when we talk about the size of our churches, we need to look at some other factors other than just numerical. Douglas Walrath, who is one of the leading national figures in the small church business, list six factors that he considers as important as to whether a church is small or not. And he says the church has four of these that it is probably would be classified as small church. Now, five of the six are non-numerical. The first characteristic, he says, if the church, if everyone can know and does know or knows about everybody else in the congregation. It's a small church if it's small enough that you can know or you do know or you know about everybody that's in the congregation. That is one of the marks of what would be a small church. Because one of the things that really is distinctive about the small church is the strong relationships, and I'll speak to that in a moment, because people know one another, and this is one of the very real and very attractive parts of the small church, is this intimate knowledge and relationship that you have with one another. The second is that relationships are warm and intimate and durable. The church basically is built on relationships. Now sometimes these are family groupings. But then again, it is often seen in such expressions as we have in the church where I'm a member, which we have about 75 or 80 on Sunday. You know, there's Miss Lucy. And Miss Lucy kisses everybody that comes. Now, some folks don't like it. I do. But, you know, she's 82, so what, you know. My wife doesn't get jealous. But there is a warm relationship. And with me, when I'm there and I miss Miss Lucy, I say, when I see her the next time, I say, you owe me one. I got a guy with two kisses. The relationships get pretty warm because, to give you an illustration, Sunday, I lost a day here, we had discovered that Miss Lucy had a checkup, and now Miss Lucy has a malignancy. So I just had to go by the house and see Miss Lucy. I want to talk with her and Dave and have prayer with them because there is a relationship. So, in the small church, relationships have a tendency to be very warm and intimate, and they're durable. They're ongoing, and which says that one of the things that, as a pastor of a small church, you have to keep this in mind, is they will maintain relationships beyond anything else. Well, what I'm trying to say, I guess, is like this. It was best expressed when I stood in the front yard of a member of my church where I was pastor, and he could stand there, and he looked out and he said, you know, man and boy, and he was in his 50s then, he said, I've never lived out of sight of this place where I live, where I'm standing. He went on to say, you know, preachers come and go, but I stay. Now, by interpretation, what was he saying?
You are an outsider.
And he was saying I was an outsider, but he was saying something else to me. What else?
I'm not part of the durable relationship.
I'm not part of the durable relationship.
Uh-huh. Not
I'm not indispensable. What he was saying to me, don't ask me to take sides. You're going to leave. I'm going to stay. And so I'm not going to get in a fight. But I'm not going to have a fuss with the folks in the church because I farm with them, I work with them, and I'm going to stay here. We're going to be here. And so those relationships are very durable, and this is one of the things that a pastor needs to learn in dealing with a small church, that oftentimes they are not going to break relationships no matter what is right. And that's difficult sometimes to bring. That's one of the problems that gets involved in trying to create change in a church. And it's one of those things that a pastor has to learn to live with, that you feel like, well, if they love me, they would stand with me. But you see, they have a deeper bond. They love you. It's not saying they don't care for you. But they know that you are a transient. And they're going to, and you will go and they will stay. Now, One of the things that Walworth uses, he says that full attendance is less than 50. In the United States, over 50% of all the churches, all churches in the United States, have less than 50 people in attendance on Sunday. We are a nation of small churches. Now, I don't like the numerical figure. It's one of those things that you throw in there because a church can have more than 50 people and still be a small church if it's operating on some of these other things. If it's everybody knows everybody, and if it has the warm, intimate, and durable fellowships. Now, the fourth criteria that he puts up is that financial resources are often inadequate or are limited. Because it just stands to reason when you have a small church, you just do not have the base. Unless it's one of those unusual churches where you have some very wealthy people. We don't have many of those. So, oftentimes, one of the things that characterizes a small church is its inability to do what it needs to do financially. The resources are limited. The fifth of them, and this one gets me into trouble frequently in talking if I have any pastors of small churches, and Walworth says that oftentimes the pastor's workload is marginal. What he's saying is that the pastor's not overworked, he is underworked. Now you think through on that. If you only have 40 or 50 people total, what do you do with your time? There's only so many, you have very few weddings unless it's marrying, and many instances you're marrying the folks second and third time around, the widows and widowers. You have several funerals, but a certain amount of sick and pastoral visitation, but what do you do with the rest of the time? And one of the things is that if a small church has a full-time pastor, oftentimes the problem relates to he is underemployed in a sense. Now, a lot of people, I was talking about this in another case, and the guy really, he came at me pretty heavy, and I finally said, I got him once, he got him calmed down. I said, tell me what you do. And he said, well, I put out the bulletin. And he started naming the things that he did. And the majority of the things he did were not related to ministry in one whit. They were not related to pastoral work. They were not related to the preaching. They were not related. They were just, it was a lot of busy things. Most of what he enumerated as part of what his duties and what he was doing were things that other people could have done. And so he kind of got over a little bit of his hostility, but he wasn't convinced that he was underemployed. But this is one of the problems. Now, this is also one of the reasons that a pastor oftentimes does move on. Because no challenge, and after all, we all do want to be, I think, at least we start out that way, to be conscientious about what we're doing. We want to be the best minister possible. And, nobody really, I guess, well, some folks do, but not many people really want to not do anything. And the sixth of these is that the church belongs to the people. That is, that the leadership rests in the congregation. It's lay-led, you would say. That most of them get along as about as well without a pastor as they do with a pastor. Now, you can look at, if you were to take the record of the church, and you didn't have the historical record that said when they had a pastor and when they didn't have a pastor, but if you just looked at the annual letter to the association, you wouldn't be able to tell much the difference between what went on. Sunday school would be about the same, offering would be about the same. Most things would run along pretty good about where they are, simply because the church belongs to the people. It's lay-led. So he says if you have any four out of these six, then the congregation is small. And you see, he gives out, five out of six are non-numerical. He also points out that whenever a church reaches the point that there's more than one center of life, or one sinner in its life, then it has become a larger church. In most small churches, the worship service is the one sinner about which it builds around. Sunday school, yes, is there, but it's what we call a single-cell church. There is one group that everybody belongs to, that one group. But whenever it gets big enough to where the cell splits and there are several groupings, then you have moved into basically a larger church. So a small church is not as always numerical. It is how the church operates and how it gets its things done. Now, when we talk, since we have so many small churches, then that means that we're going to have a lot of small church pastors. And how does one begin to, or how does one become a pastor of a small church, or wind up as a pastor of a small church, and maybe even continue as pastor of a small church? Well, sometimes, and hopefully it would be by choice. There are some men, and hopefully eventually perhaps some women, who by choice say, this is where I want my ministry to be. That would be the ideal way. This is where I'm comfortable. This is where I perceive that my gifts and my ministry is, and I choose to be here. Now, some, it is by chance. I couldn't get the brick church in the county seat, but I had a friend that recommended me to Little Hope Church out here, or Maranatha or Second Street or whatever the name of the church is. So by chance, that's the way I just sort of fell into it, kind of a thing. Now, we like to take a lot of those things and, we put them all back into the God talk, that God opened that door of opportunity. Now, the fact that that's the only one, I'm writing, jokingly, a friend of mine at the board, we say we're going to write a book on how you know God's will. And such things as, finding a parking place, then in right where you need it, that's God's will that you be there at that time, because, another great scriptural and theological truths like that. But, we have a way sometimes. We can play games with God. And I know God has a sense of humor. If he didn't, he'd strike us all dead. And he must laugh at some. He must laugh at some of the things that we do sometimes. And I'm not trying to be just facetious or cute. But sometimes by chance things happen out that way. And then a great number, it is by force or by push. It's the only opportunity that is available. And so grudgingly, and sometimes with a little bit of bitterness of spirit, which sometimes reveals itself in a sense of meanness on the part of the pastor. And I've seen a few like that, who, because they couldn't get out of it, they are there and they resent every moment of it. And they're envious of their brothers in Christ who have done better. And that's one of the things. Some of us have been out of seminary long enough, and some of you are still here, and you'll be going out. One of these days you'll go to the convention or some such place, and you'll meet a classmate. Or you'll read it what's the name of your journal? I get it all the time. What's the name? Seminary magazine. Here. And you'll read where, he's been called to First Baptist Church or wherever. And you say, I knew that guy in school. He weren't any smarter than I was. He's not, he's not as good looking. He couldn't preach near as loud as I can. Little tinge of jealousy, Why couldn't I? And there are a lot of folk like that, kind of get stuck in a way. And sometimes they pay a terrible price for it. But now let's turn and let's look at some positive aspects of why should anybody consider pastoring a small church. Now, don't always put the small church out in a rural setting. Put it in town, put it in the city, put it in the metropolitan area. Because there are a lot of small churches everywhere. The small church, particularly if you put it into its small town, village, rural setting, can offer to a person a differing lifestyle. Now, there's no mass movement for a simpler lifestyle on the part of a lot of millions of people in America, but there are some people who want a simpler lifestyle, who want to be less consumer-oriented, who would like to live at a slower pace, who would like perhaps have cleaner air and a better place to raise children, and would like to have a deeper involvement, which I'll get into a little later on. And so the small church does offer the opportunity for a simpler or differing lifestyle, that less demands are made because they're not going to be concerned what kind of an automobile you drive or whether the dress the wife or whatever wears is of the latest style. It gives an opportunity to change patterns, something of which a lot of us from time to time kind of, you know, when I get stuck in Atlanta traffic, and of course that's normal for Atlanta, there's no other way. A fellow said years ago that one day Atlanta would have a traffic jam so great that the only solution would be to pave over it and start over again. Well, we've come near that two or three times. And so there is involved a less hectic style of life by ministering in a smaller congregation. The demands are less in many ways, and they're greater in some others, and I'll touch on those. But it does lend itself toward a pace that is different. Now, it also, as part of that lifestyle, it could also let a person have the best of maybe two worlds or two interests. And that's what we call bivocationalism. Now, some people are bivocational by choice, and again, some by chance, and some by, well, there's no other way. But supposing you're interested in several different things, like the young man who came into my office several years ago, he was from Pittsburgh. He'd become a Christian. He was very active in one of our churches in Pittsburgh. He has a master's degree in metallurgy. He was a metallurgist. Had an excellent job. But God had called him to the ministry, and so he had gone to seminary and equipped himself for the ministry. But he came to see me, and because he had met me, I'd been in Pittsburgh, and so we talked. He said, you know, I really like metallurgy. He enjoyed doing that. He also liked the ministry. So I said, okay, why not best do both of them? I said, I see no reason why we couldn't find a place where you can use both skills and gifts that God's given you. And so he found a job in Midland, Michigan, the Dow Chemical Company. Using his metallurgical skills and a little church, had one of the finest pastors, a pastor they could not afford any other way. They had never had a seminary-trained pastor, but now they did. And so one of the things that sometimes the smaller church pastorate, if a person is interested in several things, you know, just like I'm interested in anything mechanical. I can watch dirt moving equipment, this kind of thing. I always want to build bridges. But nobody ever told me that, because I hadn't started out to train for bridges, I started out to be a chemical engineer. No one ever told me when God called me to preach that I could be a chemical engineer and a minister. I probably would not have been because of kind of who I am. But you see, there are people who have multiple interests, and that is not to say that it downplays one or the other. There is no real conflict, I do not think. But this can give a person, particular person who has an high energy. Now, you know, there are a lot of people are high energy people. Those are the people who hold two jobs and have a sideline. Now, this is true of a lot of bivocational ministers. They'll work full time on one job. They'll put 20 to 30 hours a week into a church and may even have another job on the side because no one thing can eat up all the energy they got going. Now, not all of them are like that, but a lot of them are. So, bivocationalism is a lifestyle. Now, if you like to be independent, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to look your church in the face and say, "I don't matter. Do whatever you please. You're not, I take my Lincoln Continental." And we got them. They drive Lincolns and Thunderbirds and Cadillacs. And I said, "I'll just get in my car and drive off." Well, it gives you a sense of nobody tells me what to do. It is if you are an independent sort. Bivocationalism gives you a tremendous... it's fun to be with them. Okay, lifestyle. Another thing that... being pastor of a small church can do for you is give you a sense of place. Now, Dr. Mayo talked about, I believe he mentioned the fact, the mobility. One out of every five people moves. And when I think back to the number of places I've lived, and I look at my own family, my three children, and realize that they don't have any sense of place. The nearest thing they have is their grandmother. Her home. And when your children say, one of your kids says, you know, "Well, if when mom does die, I hope you will buy the place because that's the nearest thing we've got to home." They don't have any place that they can, because I moved around and I grew up in a home where I moved around. So a sense of place can be very important to a lot of people. You know, it's a great deal like the fellow who came home and opened up his closet door and found a man in the closet. He said, "What are you doing here?" The guy said, "Well, everybody's got to be someplace." Well, everybody's got to be someplace, and everybody ought to have a sense of place and a place of belonging. And one of the places you can do this is if you stay long enough, you can in the small church. The bigger church, it's not necessarily so. You're one of the bunch. You're part of the crowd. Another area that is very important, I think, for if you're interested that the small church gives an opportunity, and that is if you are a person-related person. If you like people, this is one of the real positive aspects, because you can establish the kind of ongoing personal relationships. Now, not every minister wants to establish personal relationships. That plays itself out in several ways. One, it is that he accepts or takes a professional attitude toward his work. He spends a great deal of time in the study, or he may call it the office. See, it's easier to meet people, and as long as you have a desk between you and people, you're never going to have real close personal relationships. If you come into my office, my desk is pushed up against the wall, because I don't like to talk across the desk to anybody. I used to have my desk set in one of the offices a different way. I had it set at an angle so that I could turn around and I had two chairs, but there was space out in front of the desk and I had two chairs here. And when anybody came in, I talked with them, I turned around so that we were facing. It's amazing the number of people who would come in to talk with me, grab one of those chairs and drag it around on this side, because they didn't want that relationship. You know, they were more comfortable with the desk between us. So, if you are a person, you like to become part of people's lives, you like to have that personal relationship, then the small church offers that. It's difficult in a larger church because there are so many and there is neither the time and in many instances not the opportunity. So this is one of the positive aspects of being a pastor of a small church. Also, being pastor of a small church gives you the opportunity of really impacting a community. Now, you can be pastor of a pretty good sized church in a pretty good sized town, and you will make a great big impact on what happens in that city. But you, in a smaller community, the minister can have an impact on community because you are part of a group that has identity and is usually more geographically centered and, well, let me illustrate. A place up in Kentucky called Sandy Hook. Now, it's the county seat of Powell County, I guess. It ain't much town, it ain't much city. And for years we had a struggling Baptist church there in that city. It was kept alive by the WMU, the state of Kentucky. They had it as one of their missions projects. At one time it didn't have any male members. And of course, except the pastor. And, you know, when he'd come to associational meetings, we'd always kid him, well, how's your brotherhood doing? You know, do a number on the brother. That's, you know, that's, we were great at that. And anyhow, he stayed with that thing. And one day somebody got the fool notion of electing him the mayor of that town. It's less, I don't know, it must not more than 1,000, 1,200 at the most, if it's got that many. Well, at that time, there was only one paved street in that whole little town, and that was the state road that went through the middle of it, state highway. They had no water system, no sewer system, no fire system, no fire department, because without a fire, without a water system, what do you do for fire? So, because of his influence and his impact, when he came out of office, they have paved streets, they have a water and sewer system, they have a fire department. One man's impact, one pastor, of what at one time was one of the smallest churches. Of course, this has now been reflected in that this is now the dominant church. Once it was a subordinate church. It was a non-entity almost in the city. But he had the opportunity because he stayed where he was. He was in a small church, in a small community. He really left an impact, made an impact on that community. And there are persons, this is a way that we can do it. And oftentimes in the smaller church, in the smaller community, this you do have a profound effect because people know who you are. You don't have to introduce yourself. Coupled with impacting the community is a small church gives the opportunity to impact the lives of people. Now, I've talked about if you're a person, I'm talking from your standpoint. You get the full, if you like people, then the smaller church gives you the opportunity of knowing people, being intimately related, and fulfilling that side of your life. The other side of it is that you can impact the lives of other people. Because you see, you have enough time, you know those people. You go back to what Walrus' first thing was. You know, it's just as true for pastors. How a pastor ought to be able to know and to know about everybody in the church. But as the church gets any size, there's no way you can know everything. And so in a smaller congregation, you know the people. And because of knowing them, you have the opportunity of really being are getting into their lives and impacting those lives. Because you have a more sustaining, ongoing relationship. And because you have the time to change lives and to really impact lives, most often requires time. And in the busy, busy pastorate, sometimes there isn't that much time unless the congregation is small enough that you can spend with the time of people that are necessary. That you have the time to spend it with the wherever the gathering place is and talk with them. That you have the time to go to the ball games where the youth are playing. That you have the time to go by the school, to stop by the grocery store, to you have the time that is necessary to sit with somebody long enough that they will eventually get around to opening up to you. And so you have this opportunity of changing lives, of impacting lives. And then one other thing, and I tread on this one softly because it is an opportunity of modeling Christ. Hear me carefully. I wish I had the nerve to say what Paul could say, that I wish you would. Paul essentially said that, didn't he? Model yourself after me. And, you know, in a smaller community, in a smaller congregation, you're in the eyes of the people. And you have the opportunity of modeling, which is both a very scary thing and a very positive thing. You can model what it is like to be a Christian. And people can see the model. And hopefully imitate the things that are good. Now, that's a scary kind of a thing. That's a scary part of pastoring a small church, because it's like living in a fishbowl. And because they see and know, and there are very few secrets in the smaller congregation. You know, you can be pastor of a large church and do most anything, and very few people ever know about it. But in a small church, they all do. It shows itself in such ways as when I was pastor of a church, and the house I lived in was out on a ridge, and you could see it from several different directions. Well, when I would come in at night sometimes, maybe we had been out somewhere, and when I'd turn the lights on, you could see it. And usually I'd get a telephone call or two. Well, preacher, where you been? Well, I wasn't being nosy. It wasn't necessarily nosy. They were interested in what I'd been doing. They're glad I was back at the house. You know, the other side of it is, you know, the house was right by the road that a lot of people traveled, and it had Venetian shades, which are an abomination. A man ought to be tarred and feathered that invented them, but anyway. It had Venetian shades, and, you know, at night we'd close the shades, and I would bank the fire, had a coal stove, and so they didn't want me early in the morning. They didn't want me over there underfoot while they were milking cows and getting things ready, or they were getting the kids off school, or they were going into Louisville to work at GE, and all the various things they were doing. They didn't need a preacher around, but they'd say, well, preacher came by your house yesterday, and you're not up yet. Well, I thought, you know, that bothers them a little bit. So I have a simple solution to it. Every morning, I'd get up, wake up, go downstairs, open up those Venetian shades, throw a bucket, rattle the ashes out of that stove, throw a bucket of coal in there until the black smoke rolled out, and then upstairs I'd go and jump back in the bed. That made them happy. Made me happy. I got to... and I didn't argue around with them or try to even explain, you know, that while you've gone to bed, I'm out doing things, you know. I'm visiting people, I've been to the hospital, all these kind of things. It's no point in that. And so what I was doing was, you know, fitting in. Because they were concerned about, they were interested in me. And I was interested in what they did, you know. I wanted to know, you know, how were things going? And they would share. So there are some advantages. And I hope that some of you that you will examine these options, and that, you know, if the small church is your lot, or it can be a very beautiful experience. It doesn't have to be all bad and all negative. It doesn't have to be, in spite of what your brothers are going to do to you, you know, they're going to feel like, you know, he ain't doing so well. What difference does it make what he thinks if you're happy? And you can have some very fulfilling experiences. And we've got, and it's a fact of life that we've got them. Now, there's one other thing that I did not say, and I say it, and then so I can duck and run on this one, is we have to assess who we are at the point that maybe the gifts and the skills and the abilities that God has endowed us with do not equip us to pastor a larger church. You know, everybody's sitting around wondering who's going to get Wally's place down there in First Dallas. Well, a lot of them that think they'd like to have it sure can't handle it. And so it is. We assess what God has given us. If that's what God has given us, the ability, that's where we are. Maybe we're most comfortable with 40 or 50 people. A lot of people are like that. I've seen some pastors, every time the church got above 60 or 70 or 80, they eventually cut it back to 40 or 50 because that's where they were comfortable. There are many ways of doing that. Some they did consciously, some unconsciously. But thank you. Time is up.